Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
question. It's going to be specific tonight to traffic, and we're going to have a potential student appear tonight for that purpose. Also, we're going to be talking about fiat money versus substantive money, constitutional money. I'll be your moderator for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy in the Law, which is a direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. And before we get started with this evening, though, it's very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear in this call in any way, shape, or form may be deemed by you to be legal advice, financial advice, or advice for the lovelorn. If you're on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I ask very politely that you hang up on your phone. Disconnect from this call. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here, being that on any of these calls for that matter. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the other programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, an attorney, or a member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my suggestion, it's not advice, just a suggestion that you get an attorney, someone your state sanctions, to give advice in law. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. Just people saying what they might do were they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're going to just get folks' opinions on what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions. Nonetheless, it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. Let's go over a few things here with Your Remedy in the Law quite quickly. First of all, I'll take everybody to the homepage of yourremedyisinthelaw.com. Look at the upper right-hand corner where you'll see a little picture of the Constitution. You click on that, and a separate place will come up with just two items on it. These two items are certainly most important, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly, on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is a 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known as AmJur or American Jurisprudence. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America operates. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means that you have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you will find yourself in. I might add that for every hour of this 24-hour course, you may consider 10 to 15 hours of studying just what's in that 1 hour. On the right is the common law default process. It's nationally known for its high win rates in traffic tickets throughout the country. At least that's what it is most popularly acquired for, but that's not really why it's on this page. The reason we have it up here is with a jurisdictionary course is that when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it's kind of a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's the first time that they are committing to actual action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate in traffic scenarios being such a common problem in this country today. The common law defaults, also known for traffic purposes, has many other remedies and applications as well for most scenarios that you find yourself in where there is no damage or to property, to a person. It's just some government official claiming you broke a rule. Therefore, you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very reasonably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy is in the Law, you'll probably be familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremedyisinthelaw.com, you will be met with a blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue onto the site you're visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we're doing this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects as well as many other features and study groups that at Your Remedy is in the Law. Your Remedy in the Law.com is just one of a dozen, a couple of dozen actually, websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll just do that at your leisure. Do you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation? If that's so, email me at mm@yourremediesinthelaw. Or you can call the 800 number, 800-625-4250, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we are able to. Grassfire Communications, formerly known as Statewide Communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's the map of the United States you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables you to speak with one another on a local level, a local venue level, based on a very strict, pre-decided topic of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. It's actually a very easy setup, you know, just continuing here, click there, put your zip code here, click next, that sort of thing. And then we'll walk you through the remainder of the setup, and then you get to the point, we'll ask you, what are your interests? What are you interested in? This could range from anywhere from credit card issues, home foreclosures, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, perhaps personal health rights. Anything that you can think of that is in effect your personal life in one way or another, you should find in this list or something that's close enough to be related to it. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together like you'd think of it, a social network. Not that you're in a social network, it's just very custom, very private. It then puts you in contact with people in your local venue that have a common interest to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back into the hands of the common man. If you're in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, well, you just jump online one day and say, well, this happened to me today. And the first person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. That's probably not going to be a tremendous amount of help to you. And then the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do if I were similarly situated. I'd watch these specific YouTubes, and then I'd go down to the local law library at the county courthouse and get a law dictionary and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, that all sounds great, but there's a particular website you could check out that has educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then you could go and do some due diligence on what you're reading. Just people, self-suggestions, people's opinions. But if you do this, if you do your due diligence and educate yourself, perhaps the further you got into it, you discover that it's not as difficult as you initially thought, and it would be because you focused on one single subject, and you've got to get to the point where you're investigated yourself now, and you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that, and that's all that we're trying to do here at Grassfire Communications. It's very simple to get people started talking again amongst themselves. Of course, there is no cost for using Grassfire Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we're hopeful that you'll pass this information around. If this is not an option for you today, there's always Freedoms Radio, freedomsradio.com. If you're on the road and you don't want to deal with the card process, your remedy is in the law, and you don't have your username and password with you, well, therefore, you can just see the phone number and PIN. And by the way, if you want to pick up membership too, your remedy is in the law.com is very easily. You just simply click on the registration button, and so that's your basic information placed there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate, and after that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your bank card or your PayPal. Did you know every single call is recorded? Years of archives to go through, a vast knowledge of knowledge, a wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over the air, 9 o'clock Eastern, 6 o'clock Pacific. There's also the question box there where you can type in your question, click submit as long as it's within certain call hours. And your written question will pop up on the moderator screen. We'll do our best to read every single one of these questions out over the years, as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get to talk directly with the informational provider like you would by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. And there's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio. So no matter where you are in your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, your buyer beware. Your remedy is in the law, is under the umbrella of Americans Restoring America. When you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you're doing just that. Information providers' payments for advertising are at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider, along with other expenses that you might have or they might have associated with your particular product or service. So when you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, your issues, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And then we make those introductions. Not all teaching efforts by the information provider is always going to be successful. Everyone always hopes for the best. We plan for the best. And believe you me, we aim for the best. The things do happen. Bad things happen. And when they do, you have to wrestle with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions on that, we welcome you to visit yourremediesinthelaw.com/testimonials. And there you'll see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not at your remedies in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call in and you go with a particular information provider, that's exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or credit should be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider. And even then, it's very few and far between circumstances that are going to be worked. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, and pertaining here to all the information providers at your remedies in the law, we've got to remind everyone that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that the speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn. But please, you must always be civil. The size of a question, if closed properly, and then answered properly, then we should all learn something from it. All right. Well, that's my rant for this evening. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to our speaker's host this evening.
And that would be me. So let me ask you a question. What is the difference between a lien and a levy? Another question might be, what is a judgment lien? What is a judgment as opposed to being a lien or a levy? These are questions that we're going to be talking about tonight, and our brother John is going to be here to share that with us. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn this call over to Brother John.
Well, thank you for your kind and gracious introduction. Thank you, both of you. The concept of somebody establishing a lien or a levy is usually a function of that they see something that you have that they need or want or they believe they deserve. And to that end, if there's enough there to warrant their interest, they'll go to get a judgment to do that. And a lot of times that takes significant time, resources, and monetary consideration to be successful at that. To get a lien or a levy through a judgment, a lien on your home or a levy on your payroll, that requires a teeny-weeny bit of paperwork that sometimes takes not just days but weeks to prepare. And if you're having somebody with a jurisprudent background prepare that for you, it takes a little bit of liquid resources and some finances to be able to be successful at completing that task, because you're going to have to pay them before they will produce the lien or levy or the application for the court injunction or the levy against your paycheck. And so the bottom line is that liens and levies and judgments require a lot of money and time to be able to set up. To that end, years ago, a lady had hit a dog, and I've referred to this example once previously. There was a dog ran out in the road, and she hit the dog, and it got wedged up in the left fender well, and the car veered off the highway, coincidentally into the same yard of the owner that owned the dog, knocked down the white picket fence, and killed a four-year-old little girl. There was no criminal charges levied at the time against the driver. She was 61 years old, and what happened was that the family, the distraught family, tried to get criminal charges pressed against her, but could not. What happened was that they hired an attorney to go after this lady and her assets. After significant research, the law firm, coincidentally in Southern California, had gone through this lady's everything she owned with a fine-tooth comb, come to find out that she didn't own the house she was living in. The car was property of a trust, and she was no longer employed, and the couple of million-dollar judgment that they they had attempted to seek, the law firm advised the family to take their lumps and go, and this was after they collected a $200,000 retainer from the family, that where the family had mortgaged their own home to pay for the legal assistance to go after this lady. Okay, the thing was is that of all the time that the law firm was going to put into going after her and getting this judgment, turnips don't bleed. She's 61. She was no longer employable due to a health problem. She had retired less than 8 months earlier, and her home was actually owned by some children of a friend, and was being managed through a trust that the husband, before he passed away, had set up. The wife didn't agree with it. She bemoaned it bitterly that somebody else had control of the assets that she and her husband had worked so many years, all their lives, to obtain. Well, when she found out that they were dropping the case and that they had already filed the case in Superior Court in Los Angeles, and all of a sudden to find out that a case that had multi-million dollars for different aspects of the cause of action that they were complaining about, that when she found out that it evaporated and fell in the dirt, she didn't seem to have a problem with the fact that her husband's best friend's daughter was the trustee for the house that had been transferred into something similar to a charitable religious trust 18 years earlier. That was the date that they paid it off. Well, the home, when they paid it off at that time, was worth over $300,000, when 18 years later, it was now worth $750,000 in the Los Angeles housing market. When the attorneys first went after it, they did a search on the property, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but they didn't get a complete search. And back then it was because all the records were manual. They were not computerized. This is in late 70s. They didn't realize that she didn't actually own it. It was in a trust. It wasn't until one of their employees stumbled on the fact that the property tax bill was going to a completely different address, to a trust, and they had a rental agreement between the mother, who is now 61, and the trust, and she was making monthly payments to the trust for the rental agreement. And when they found that out, that's when they dropped the case, because they were hoping to at least squeeze the house for $750,000. It didn't happen. There's many, many times when, because something didn't appear to be financially salvageable, that they individuals gave up. When I was in school, there was a event where this research and this company called Pacific, actually I shouldn't use the company name, this California-based corporation, two of the professors decided they wanted to take a field trip on a litigation case, and we were all forced to sign NCNDAs, non-disclosure agreements, to get to the, and I say forced because we were told that there would be 8 of these field trips, and if we missed any one of them, there was no way we could get a 4.0 in the class, and that if we missed 2 of them, the best we would get is a 2.0. And so we were held hostage. And those NDAs have long since expired, but what happened was is that we were in this room where there was close to 80 individuals in this boardroom, that over half of them were attorneys. And this technology company was convening this meeting for the purpose of determining how long they could infringe upon the intellectual property of this couple, and then non-suit out of court before they actually ended up in court. For no further infringement, and after they had saturated the market was supposed to be the Defense Department was their exclusive market. And there was a handful of things that when it happened that the couple didn't have much for assets, they infringed upon them very, very strongly, very hard. They actually had gotten to the place after 3.5 years, and that's when we came in on it, come to find out that they had gotten the defense contracts that they were hoping for, and they were going to agree to non-suit with the family. After the family, they had investigators that went in and figured out which bank the loan on the house was with, you know, it was mortgaged to. They found out where the cars were. They went through all the family records and determined every person that might consider helping them in a legal battle to determine how much money they needed to throw at this. The issue was they were trying to figure out what assets could be brought to bear against them. And finally, after the couple had all but lost the home, They mortgaged it to pay the attorney's fees and everything, et cetera. And their three children had mortgaged all of their assets, and the wife's brother had mortgaged his assets. They one thing they hadn't considered was the wife's brother was married, and she had a sister that was unbelievably wealthy. And at the very, very last second, she came in with funds to defend the couple and go after this this technology company, and it completely turned things around, and they ended up getting a counter judgment against them. But what happened was is that based on the individual's perception of how much cash they did or didn't have, or that they didn't know about, they were making all these judgments. There was a gentleman who lived right across the taxiway from me and down two hangars. He had a TBM Avenger. He had the TBM Avenger that George Herbert Walker Bush Sr. flew over two dozen missions in. And it still had his inscription stamped on some of the hardware inside of the and painted on the outside of the aircraft. It was in the Bombay. Every pilot that had flown that aircraft had signed his name in a felt marker, and every time he flew it. And this was this gentleman took his airplane two doors down to the gentleman right across the taxiway from me to get it maintained, and they were testing it, and they did something very, very dumb. They were pointing the aircraft at the hangar. They closed the doors, and they were doing the run-up to see if the engine was performing properly. Well, the aircraft, the brakes accidentally slipped, and the aircraft jumped the chocks, and the propeller made a whole new entry into the hangar, damaged the hangar doors, etc. The prop was badly mutilated. The engine was damaged. It was very serious. The owner of the hangar tried to sue Bill for what he had done and what he had. It turns out that when he found out that the airplane that Bill had always said that he owned was owned by a corporation. And at that juncture, it turns out that that was the only thing that was held by that corporation. He tried to sue Bill for Bill's hangar. Bill had his hangar in a trust. David went and sued him for all of his four sports cars that he had in the hangar there, only to find out that as he got the license plate numbers, come to find out that every one of them was held by a trust. He gave up. It was so bad, and every one of those cars was held by a different trust. It was so bad that David didn't have the money, even if he was to mortgage his own hangar and both of his Beechcraft Bonanzas, that he wouldn't be able to muster enough to do the legal battle to go after Billy. Okay. I knew Billy for quite a few years. In fact, when I worked in California, he worked for Continental Airlines, where I worked, and his office was right around the corner and down the hall from mine. And he was the chief pilot at the time. This is long before he retired. But Billy had assets he tucked away that nobody could believe. But Billy, his wife, before they divorced, had a bad car accident. She was drinking. She hit not one, not two, but she played billiards. She hit three cars in one intersection, and two of the people almost died. One of them was paralyzed, paraplegic. They tried to sue Bill and Jenny for everything that they had. They got past it. Nobody got a penny. Jenny didn't stop her drinking, so Bill divorced her. Jenny tried to sue in the divorce for half the assets under California law. She tried to sue for half of his paycheck. His paycheck was being paid to a trust. He didn't own anything directly, none of the cars, nothing. And so she basically, for spousal support, et cetera, she didn't get anything. It's just unbelievable. And California is one of six states that things are a little little tough when it comes to having a nasty divorce. Some of you are familiar with the Bible, and then there's a term or there's a passage that says, "And Jacob took Rachel into his tent, and they were married." It was the physical union that consummated and made the marriage. The public ceremony that her father threw for them did not constitute marriage. In 162 countries, 50 states, and all the territories held possessions of the United States, including Guam, Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, etc., if there has been no physical union, there is no consummation of the marriage. Now, originally, a marriage license was exclusively for the purpose of allowing owned property to be joined, but the problem was is that the product of that relationship was now adjudicatable property of the state. We're talking about slavery. We're talking about slaves from two different plantations being able to be married, owned property, and to keep the property owners, the plantation owners, from arguing over it. It required that the children who required, it was required that those children had a certificate of birth that were now adjudicatable property of the state, meaning that the situation, they could take the children away, they could say who could keep them, but the state had full authority. Now, that's the reason why most people's our children have a cloud over them. Most of our children, in that CPS has jurisdiction over most of the children. But if the parents do not have a marriage license, and remember, a license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal, and until the last 150 years, 172 years and 3 months and 4 days, the concept of a license for getting married was just non-existent. The marriages were always recorded in the family Bible or on a certificate provided by the clergy, where there were two witnesses that indicated that they had entered into a marriage. But if the physical consummation never occurred, and that was one of the reasons why King Henry VIII's sixth wife and seventh wife were executed, is because they never actually, it was his incapacity to consummate the marriage. As bad as it sounds, he couldn't keep up his end. And to that end, when the queen wanted a divorce, he just simply had her executed. And that's why the church did not complain, because technically she was never the queen. And so the Church of England did not complain at all. But today I was on a conference call 7 hours ago, where an individual who he met this girl, they cohabitated, they had two children, and he bought a house And this is in Pennsylvania. But he bought a house, and then a year and a half, almost 2 years later, got married, and they had four bloody, rugged years of marriage. Things, you know, he took her out for a test drive. Okay, that was wonderful. They had children, okay, and the things were going well. It was like from the day they said I do, things began to go downhill. And right now, and she just finished suing him for divorce, but before the judge would divide the assets, he asked the question, when was the house purchased? And when were the children born? And when he realized that the children were born before the marriage, before they got married, but, and that the house was purchased after the children were born, that they were legally married. Now, this gentleman on this conference call, I felt really bad for him, but he complained bitterly and bemoaned that they, the state had taken his house and made him sell it, have it, and he objected to that. So what they did was they made him appraise it and then pay her half of the appraised value. And the thing was is that it's there was a comment that had he put it in a trust that it wouldn't have been available for her to come after. There, some of what's happening is that she, excuse me, her attorney put on the dog and had every aspect of this gentleman's life looked into, including his P files, his personnel files at work, to determine if he was up for coming up for promotion. And they went after everything, half of his salary, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And she was determined to never work again, and that he was going to pay for it. Now, the thing that may have been overlooked was that she originally was looking to raise a family, didn't care who the father was, and was going to see how far she could go. And when somebody seduces somebody into bed and gets pregnant and, okay, you move in together and then does it twice, you know, you think the second time you'd realize that there was something wrong. And she sang the song of the Sirens of Titan, and the gentleman that brought her to me today has been on this call many, many times. But we've since did a little bit of research and come to find out that every aspect of this guy's life was laid bare by looking into what he owned. He made no consideration about protecting his assets from lien, levy, or judgment. There's many of you have been on Justice Brashear's call. Justice Brashear's right now is he's still getting over some very, very serious health problems. There were some health challenges that almost took his life. Actually, almost took his life more than once. But he, Justice Brashear, has been for years setting up entities that individuals that have run into trouble. And I've known Justice Brashear only about 30 years. It's about half my lifetime. And we've been very familiar. We've spilled a lot of the same blood and the same mud together. But he is an absolute expert at setting up entities that the IRS blesses. And Justice Brashear will show you how to work with the IRS and be able to function, okay? There's ways to protect your income from lien, levy, or judgment, and or even taxation. And for that call, for that one, you need to be on the Wednesday night call to pick up we call him Herr Schlevens, his LLCs, but all of this to be said that if you do not plan ahead in advance to protect your assets, if you fail to plan, you know, there's some of you guys who know exactly who I'm quoting. It's an old A.L. Williams insurance saying, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. And what happens is that protecting your assets in advance is something that it's like the guy who calls up the IRS treasury agent and says, is this deductible or was that deductible? And they say, of course not. It's not, absolutely not deductible. And the guy says, why do you say that without knowing all the – he says, the mere fact that you're asking me means that when you went out to dinner and you rang up that bill that you were not planning on doing business ahead of time, therefore it's not deductible. If you planned ahead and you knew that that was a business deduction, when you bought that motorcycle or that car or that computer or went out to dinner, then you wouldn't be asking me the question if it is deductible, because it was in advance. And I even listened to one call sitting in a treasury agent's office where she told the lady, look, if I see that on your return, she says, you're going to go to jail. And it was just that simple. Failing to plan means you plan to fail. You know, and while A.L. Williams, I had a lot of respect for them. They did a good job. My wife was even an insurance salesman back in the 80s for A.L. Williams in the 70s before I met her. And they actually, even afterward, for about 12 years into our marriage, she still kept her insurance license. But it was, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. And some people say, well, John, I'm not well-heeled enough financially to consider doing something like that right now. And maybe you're not, okay? But if all of a sudden somebody thinks in their mind that you have something that they want and they're going to take you to task and suit like the folks at that technology company did, and they all of a sudden you find yourself under assailment and you do not have the capacity to defend yourself financially, you know, there's an old saying about at the patent office, U.S. patent office in Virginia there, that your capacity to defend an intellectual property is only as big as your war chest. It's only the strength of your ability for your defense is directly coefficient to how many zeros you have between a whole number that's to the left of the decimal place. And if they're going to come after you, maybe you have access to assets. But if they know it, they're going to prepare to do battle with what they can find and what they see. But if they can't see those, if they're coming after you like the lady that had the car accident that killed the little girl, and that lady, I used to use the term elderly till 61 was a signpost a few mile markers back in my life, but she just passed away about 8 months ago. She didn't have anything. She didn't own anything except a laptop. And when the probate hearing was held for her, because the last 17 months of her life, she was in a car accident and she was badly injured, and both of her children had previously deceased. She was remanded to a facility, a hospital in Maywood, California, by the California Department of Adult Protective Services, and which meant that once you become a ward of Adult Protective Services, they control all your assets. Well, what happened was that her assets had quietly transferred complete and full a total of $14.5 million worth. Over 70% of that was property in Southern California, passed quietly and pleasantly to the children that the trustees were managing. And California Adult Protective Services didn't even, there was no way for them to know that Shelley had those assets and that she was that wealthy. When she ended up in the hospital, the grandchildren didn't know about it. They were advised by the trustees after the trustees found out what had happened to Shelley. And that's if there was a crime involved, that was the crime. But what happened was that California Adult Protective Services and at the probate hearing, all they adjudicated was her laptop that she had in the hospital at Maywood Health and Wellness on Pine Street in Maywood, California. And they deemed that the laptop, after having the hard drive erased, should be given to Maywood Health and Wellness at 6371 Pine Street in Maywood, California. Nobody knew about the millions of dollars because they were in trust with trustees. Shelley hadn't really associated with many of the people. The grandchildren all lived in other states far away and hadn't really directly interfaced with grandma for quite a few years, for 4 or 5 years, we found out. So when she ended up in the car accident and was deemed incapacitated, and she was in her 90s, almost nobody knew about it. She hadn't actually recovered enough of her memory to be able to explain to everybody who she really was, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I only found out about what happened to her because my adopted grandmother was in the same hospital. But that's where my adopted grandmother wanted to be. But if you have assets that are hanging out there in the wind that are on a list at the local tax assessor collector's office of properties that you and your wife own, that you go down to the Department of Motor Vehicles and they can pull up your name and they find out that you own three boats and three regular boats and two go-fast boats, and you own a motorhome and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You're easy pickings. It's very, very important that somebody who knows what they're doing help you protect your assets from lien, levy, and judgment. And it's not something to be taken lightly. There's a lot of people that have lost everything because they didn't do any planning. And what happened was after a little difficulty with that occurred after the Chappaquiddick. Hotel difficulty. Had a little accident, got drunk, there was a fatality involved. Well, he disappeared overnight, but by morning he didn't own anything. Well, now they've got laws that go back so that somebody, if you declare bankruptcy, And they'll ask, was the property transferred within the last 10 years, especially if you're filing Chapter 13, because of this little Kennedy difficulty, so that the next morning, not even the car that he had the accident in that the young lady was killed in was in his name the next morning. And you know that that had to, that took some horsepower to do that, because somebody got into the Department of Motor Vehicles and did that over the weekend on days off, okay? You have to plan ahead, and there are some individuals, there are students. There's one student on this call right now that recently filed Chapter 13, and on there there was a question, has this property, any property you have or have an interest in, was it changed hands within the last 10 years? List all properties you've had interest in within the last 10 years. You know, and there's some teeny bit of nasty unkindness for people who lie on those questions. But it makes a point that if you're going to truly do any proper preparation to protect yourself from lien, levy, or asset, the preparation should extend, hopefully, more than 10 years from any event where it could, there could be a challenge or ill consideration there. So with that, at this juncture, if I was to offer a humble suggestion that any of you have any serious assets, remember when you die, the assets, most of you have marriage certificates, marriage licenses. The certificate of marriage is one thing, but a marriage license is the opposite. That means the state you have that marriage license in has the authority to adjudicate and probate your estate. And that's why, as strange as it sounds to most individuals' beliefs, that's why a state can take a third of your assets at probate court, because they are a three-way partner in your arrangement, your assets. And so what's happening is that if you think you own everything, remember, when you step into eternity, you own nothing. Why not divest yourself of it before you get to eternity, so that maybe all that hard work that you did can be a benefit to your children or your grandchildren, or that benevolent organization that you spent so many years, whether it's Boy Scouts or foreign missions or a home for the elderly or a park, you know, that and I know one gentleman who, he was a property development genius. He and his wife Shirley, they were billionaires, and they, with their assets, 3 years before Shirley passed away, she knew she wasn't doing so slick. They put most of their money into trust and set up foundations, of all things, to take care of a whole bunch of parks in the Texas area, and I had the honor and privilege of helping build two of those parks myself when many, many years ago, 30 years ago, but Jack and I were always conspiring as something to do for a give back. And but when Jack passed away in a boating accident in Louisiana, when the boat sank and Jack drowned while on a fishing trip, a day fishing trip, every one of those parks got an immediate upgrade. And there, it was unbelievable. But quietly, different supervisors and different councilmen in different places and judges had plaques made that Jack and Shirley Ann and their likeness is listed on. So if you're going to do something with whatever you work so hard with, and it's not going to your children, or maybe you don't have children, do something to to protect it from lien, levy, or judgment, so that when the long haul comes, that you will have made a difference in either the lives of your children, your grandchildren, or maybe some park somewhere or some hospital. With that, my time is coming to a close. I want to thank you all for your patience and your graciousness. At Americans Restoring America, we're trying to help raise the bar academically so that each and every one of you will know the background, the who, what, when, where, how, and why of what and how things are done, so that when it comes to your chance to make a difference, that you will be academically equipped to do the right thing and make the right judgment to help restore liberty to America, or at least just to your fellow person. And to that, thank you for your kindness and your gracious and letting me serve beside you. Back to you, Michael.
All right. Thank you so very much, Brother John. Thank you. Just to let you know, we have with us a special guest tonight, Johnny Ringo. Welcome to the call, sir. And it's press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. Press star 2. I would say that it's very important to have some questions tonight so that, you know, we can, as you know, John is tired, so am I. So let's get some questions here and we can say goodnight. I'm going to check Freedom's Radio first here. Press star 2 on your keypad. Press star 2 on your keypad. Raise your hand. I'm refreshing. Let's see what we got here. Johnny Ringo, you got anything interesting to share with us about what's happened in the last few weeks?
Yeah, I mean, your opinion and John's opinion on two questions. Now, over the winter, I've been reading some books by Thomas Paine and John Hancock, Monroe, Thomas Jefferson, Madison. These are all leather-bound books that I acquired through my friend. And the one question I've got, or rather two of them, does the Constitution apply to state nationals? Now, I know you guys did a lot of on the citizenship programs, and I was just wondering on your opinions of this.
The Constitution, correct me if I'm wrong, Michael can actually ramble off a lot of the supporting documentation faster than I can, but the Constitution applies to anything that has a pulse and can fog a mirror that enters U.S. soil, or that the moment they have feet on U.S. soil or territory or held possession, the U.S. Constitution applies to that individual unequivocally.
Okay, because on these books that I've read, they described how they formed the Constitution, and it applies to federal, according to them, to federal individuals on it. So,
Oh, Johnny, you know what? Good point. Very good point. Your point's even stronger than you make it. There are two constitutions. There is a constitution for the aggregate, of which before our place burned down, I had two copies that were wax sealed that were passed to me by my great-great-grandfather that he got from the Library of Congress. And I had a third one that was unsealed that was open. And when the nation declared bankruptcy in 1933, a constitution for the corporation was established, and there are just some slight differences, including the 16th Amendment. And some people say, well, the old 16th Amendment. No. That's a constitution for the corporation, and you are absolutely right. The constitution for the corporation applies exclusively to federal citizens.
Okay, that's. That I agree with that. And also, the second question is on the Second Amendment. The way I interpret it and the way these five men interpreted it is that the Second Amendment applies to federal militias only. Now, I've gotten some interesting conversations about that at some of the gun shops that I frequent once in a while. And you see a lot of these people really, let's say, come alive. The dead comes alive when you mention this. And none of them really understand the Second Amendment. What is your opinion on it?
Both the Second Amendment. Now, remember when Ben Franklin was leaving the Second Continental Congress, he was stopped by a lady and asked, "Good sir, what kind of government have you given us?" And he said, "The republic, if you have the temerity of character to keep it." The Second Amendment at that time was not enacted so individuals could hunt or get food, etc. It was because we had a government that in the Declaration of Independence said that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that men are endowed with by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And among these, indicating it's from a list, larger list, are the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And to support and sustain these rights, governments are instituted among men at the permission of the governed. Me and
that's
Ben
correct.
Franklin, or Abraham Lincoln, at his 1862 Gettysburg Address, you know, finished with the last sentence saying, "This is the government of the people, by the people, and for the people," which indicates that the people are the highest form of government. And the when they can't do something, you need work done, they're not able to, they hire help. Sanitation workers, DOT personnel, air traffic controllers, governors, presidents, sheriffs, judges. Oh, by the way, those last four, they're just temp help. They have to get their jobs. They have to go reapply for their job regularly. But what happens is that they are hired help. And I've told this story many, many times. This gentleman walks out into his factory and goes finds five of his employees behind a machine drinking coffee and smoking. And he queries them, "Why aren't you guys working?" And one of them scratches his head and looks at him and says, "We didn't know you were watching." And the thing is that employees sometimes will get away with whatever they can. We're all lazy. We don't like work. In fact, two things don't impress me: blood and pain, especially my own. But the bottom line, is that we're inherently lazy. And so are everyone, judges, presidents. Those guns weren't there for hunting. They were to make sure that we kept the hired help in step. And Thomas Jefferson said, "The tree of liberty must be refreshed with the blood of patriots and tyrants from time to time." Well,
correct.
If we're responsible enough to reel in them when they first start to color outside the lines, then we don't have to go to that distance.
Okay. Yeah, I was interested in your opinion of it.
I have a question.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Johnny.
Johnny?
Hey, it's Johnny? Always an honor and a privilege to have you. Go ahead.
I appreciate that.
Which is greater, the Creator or that which the Creator created? Which is greater, the Creator or the created?
That of which, if there is a Creator, you know, this country,
Johnny?
And the majority,
Johnny?
Of people agree that there's a Creator. It's
if you build a computer, Johnny, which is greater, the thing you built or you?
thing I built.
Is that greater than you?
Absolutely, because it'll benefit other people or other individuals, whereas I have very little to contribute. But if I create something and others benefit by it, that's what I create is a lot better or more efficient than me. That's my opinion. That's the way I look at it. Because I doubt if there is, I know there's a lot of contest, if there is a creator.
When I asked about the creator, I wasn't talking about the Almighty One, the one that people call God. I was talking about
the
general. Yeah, my question is very low-key and general, yeah, which is greater, the creator of something or that which the creator created?
In my opinion, it's that of which the creator has created.
Okay, well, you took all the thunder out of my argument.
May I ask
ahead,
a follow-up question on that?
Sure.
Okay, Johnny. Okay, if we have to ask the question that there's a stipulation that only one can survive, the most important, either the creator or the creation, now which is who, and this is your acid test, now which one's most important?
The creation.
Okay, so the creator that created that creation, we're going to delete him or her or it in favor of the that which was created, correct?
Right, because the creator has got limited time. What you create does not have limited time. It goes on forever.
So the creator, we're going to eliminate the creator so he doesn't dare make a second one or a third one or a 27th one or 3 billion or 3 trillion, 792 billion, 874 more because we've lost him permanently. We're going to settle for the one that he did make, and when it expires or dies or fails, now we've lost everything. Is that what you're saying?
No, what I'm saying is the creator is insignificant because he'll pass on. But what he has created will continue on.
Can you give me an example on that, Johnny Ringo? A historical example.
Okay, for example, Bill Gates, how's that for an example? Him and his buddy, they created a computer, right?
Well, actually, he stole it from other people, but go ahead.
Let's give him credit for that he created a computer. Okay, you pass on, and his buddy will pass on. Okay, they were the creator, but what they created will continue on, supposedly, for eternity. So their creation is greater than the creator because it benefits everybody. The creator does not. He's gone. He's history.
Okay. Okay, thank you for sharing that. I may disagree with that a teeny weeny bit. And I'm one of those people that I'm also a scientist, and I have seen beyond the shadow of a doubt that this sorry, miserable third rock from the sun that we call planet Earth and home, that there is an intelligent designer of that. And that intelligent designer, if any of the documentation on him is even vaguely true, then he transcends expiration. So if that was the case, then what do you say about the creator versus us, you and me, the creation that we pass away?
Well, first of all, creator, is there a creator? If there was a creator, what documentation is there? Everything is man created. Man created multiple gods or creations by their own imagination. There is absolutely no proof, none. If the Creator was so almighty, why didn't he write something down himself? Okay, your argument will be, say, yeah, he created the Ten Commandments. Okay, where are they? They were embedded in stone. Well, nobody's ever seen them. They've been in hiding for 4,000 years. So where, if the Creator is so great, why doesn't he prove that he does exist instead of man having to create him by their documents? And not his, because his does not exist. It's only by belief that he exists.
Well, the evidence that he existed still is out there, or there's evidence that he exists is still there. I have personally seen the images of horses' hooves and chariot wheels on the bottom of the Red Sea floor, miles from either shore. Indicating that that these chariot wheels and everything and the horses' hooves that were out there were alive when they got there, and then all of a sudden drowned, which indicates that at that point that the depth of the Red Sea is almost 1,100 feet deep. And now, contrary to its surrounding topography, that is a shallow portion that of the Red Sea, but at the same time, I've seen images of that boat in the mountains of Ararat before the volcano erupted in this in 1977. I saw images of that satellite photo images of that boat before the volcano erupted and broke it into the multiple small pieces. But that's the testament of this large boat that somehow got up in these mountains and was left there when waters receded. In 1984, I was going to be part of an expedition to climb Mount Everest with Continental Airlines, a bunch of other pilots and individuals. My reason for going was that I heard that less than 300 feet from the summit, sandstone had been discovered that had marine fossils in it, indicating that at one point that was underwater, and that it was very, very specific on the dating. I've actually been within 87 feet of the Ark of the Covenant. I don't know if the stone tablets were still in it when I was there, but I was within 87 feet of the Ark of the Covenant, the real one, not the one that Solomon had made for the Queen of Sheba for her son to take with him. That is referred to by that movie, that Harrison Ford movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark. And it wasn't a sandstorm that lasted 11 months. It was actually 14 months that covered that city after they returned with the replica to when the Queen of Sheba returned home, because the high priest would not allow her son to sit on the throne like Solomon wanted because he was tainted blood. Okay. But, there's too much evidence for me to personally to not believe that this young man who in the annals of the kings of five different nations, most specifically the most prominent one, Rome, that they wrote about this young Hebrew rabbi, Jewish rabbi or teacher that went around healing the sick and made the lame walk and the blind saw, and he raised the dead, and that he even, to prove he could do it, raised himself from the dead. And in the witnesses, usually if somebody was going to lie about something, most people don't like blood or pain, whether like me, but every one of these witnesses that was tortured clung to their testimony to death that they had seen Yeshua walking after he was crucified and buried in the sepulcher,
at Mount Moriah there. So there's, and the cross hole that's still there, there was a doctor that pioneered the technology to reconstitute dry DNA. And technology shows that there has never been any evolved species of dry DNA. Are using the dry DNA, and the Peking man and all these other Promethean man that were discovered turned out to be, when they reconstituted the DNA from the inside of the bones, they turned to be a pig. One is a pig, one of them is a boar, you know, but there were no form of man. There's never been evolution. And bones that have been excavated from graves, they're finding out that there has been no transitional DNA ever. And in Colorado Springs, at the core samples that they took from Antarctica and the Sahara Desert, they have the DNA of the plant structure that indicates that they were all at one time lush tropical vegetated areas. And the DNA from the, not just the flora, but the fauna is still the exact same as it is today. And some of that dry DNA that was reconstituted from that crack in the cross hole that you can go see just out of the North Gate to this day, it's right above the bus station parking lot there, that it has not two strands of 23 like a normal strand of DNA. It has only one strand of 23. It's an X chromosome, and it has a single Y chromosome. Okay, there's too many things like this that I have not secondhand, but I have personally been there to see and witness. And so I personally am convinced beyond the shadow of a doubt that there is an intelligent designer of this sorry, miserable third rock from the sun that we call planet Earth and home. And whether you want to call them space, what do you want to call them, space aliens or E.T. or Yahweh or Allah or, you know, whatever, Buddha, you know, or Jesus Christ, that intelligent designer, Johnny Ringo, I'm convinced that intelligent designer exists. You can address them however you want to, you know, and I'm not going to, you know, get between, you know, an argument about what he's called, because I think I have a good idea. But do I know for certain? No way. I am very positive that intelligent designer does exist.
I appreciate your opinion. I'm open to all opinions and everything, and so it's very interesting. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right.
I appreciate you, Johnny Ringo. You bless my heart, brother.
You
do bless my heart, Johnny Ringo. Okay, you can stay.
All right.
Back to you, Michael.
Yeah, the next raised
Michael?
Hand.
He's in on this.
Say it again, Johnny.
Where's Michael? He's supposed to be in on this, isn't it?
Yeah, back. Okay, well, I think you and I, we can just go to agree to back to Michael.
Okay. So our next hand raised is Jennifer out of New York. Go ahead, Miss Jennifer.
Oh, hi, everybody. So I've heard in the past that something can be in your name and still, because you're the trustee or overseer or whatever, it can be considered to be owned by the trust. And I'm just wondering how that works, because I have one little piece of land in my name, and would they be able to take it, or would I be able to say, well, that's actually in part of the trust type of thing?
That's a good question, Jennifer. I'm glad you asked that. Now, if I remember right, you have a corporation sold in multiple charitable religious trusts that hold most of your properties, correct?
Right.
Okay. Now, until those properties, either whether you own it or the charitable religious trust owns it, until you either are able to establish title in Allodium, where it goes back to an original land grant that says that the individual property owner is the highest taxing authority for that property, much the same way like the Stephen F. Austin land grant in Texas says, you know, and many of the other. I was looking at a Louisiana land grant just a couple weeks ago, an original document that I believe it was President Jackson, Andrew Jackson, that signed it, that they say that the property owner is the highest taxing authority. And if you can trace back so that at no time, like there's a portion of the Stephen F. Austin land grant where 27 sections were conveyed by the owner, and there was a taxing authority set up to fund the tax office and to fund the county and the corporation that he set up personally to set up this town in his daughter's name. Now, if you can do that one item or establish that the corporation or the charitable religious trust is covered under a chapter 501c3 or chapter 508 AC2 or 2A1, then what happens is that they can still tax it, and if the taxes aren't paid, you can still lose it. But otherwise they can't take it for a lien levy or judgment against you.
Well,
does that make sense?
Yes. I just wondered because I had heard that, so I bought it in my name, that I shouldn't have done that. And so I'm just wondering how to create a document that would legally pass as a getting it out of my name and putting it into a trust, like a warranty deed type of thing, rather than a...
Yes, rather than a quit claim deed.
Right.
Yeah. I see where you're going on this. And you know what? Part of this is that you're having to ask this question. I know this was that there was an information provider previously that was going to help take care of this before he had to retire. And that, you know, and I hope, you know, that I can still do you service and help you through this. right now, as you know, I'm on walkabout helping a lot of our students do different things. And by the way, for that, have you gotten the paper judgment yet from that hearing that we were in last week, that you and I were in?
Is that the order?
Did you get the order delivered by a U.S. mail?
No, just an email, and it's on the NYSEC, whatever you call it, website. But nothing
okay.
In the mail.
So you just got an email. When did you get the email?
I think it was on the same day, on the 8th.
Okay. We need to go ahead and file that motion for reconsideration. We need to finish getting that together very, very quickly.
I just got the transcript today, and I sent it over.
Okay, wonderful.
And I also sent you the first transcript where the lawyer Barreto answered the judge, yes, I do have the original application. When
excellent. Those are the two documents we need for the motion for reconsideration. Thank you.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
I sent you a copy of the order as well.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anything else you have, young lady?
Is there anyone else? I know there's no one else as smart as you, but is there anyone else who could help with the deed in Michael's bevy of beauties, bevy of intelligent providers, information providers?
Let me get with Michael tomorrow on that. I might try to get with him tonight on that, but let's get with him tomorrow. And how about if you give us a call Thursday morning sometime? How's that sound?
Okay, thanks. Sounds good.
Okay. The Father's blessings be upon you, young lady. And you behave yourself now.
Never.
Hey, I once knew a young lady that was so well behaved, we called her misbehaved. And back to you, Michael.
Thanks.
I once knew this young lady from Dallas who had, no, never mind, we don't do limericks here, do we?
No, we're not going there.
Thank you, John, for a wonderful call this evening. Thank you, Johnny and Jennifer, for your comments and questions. Anyone else, press star 2 on your keypad. Otherwise, we're going to turn to John now and ask for any final thoughts that he may have. All right, go ahead, John. Any thoughts? Anyone's closing comments?
Ben Franklin made very clear that if we didn't cling to what we had and we had the temerity of character to keep it, that it could and would go away. Thomas Jefferson made it clear that the freedoms that we enjoy were not free. There was a cost. And every one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were very wealthy at one time. They all knew that signing that document, which was the right thing to do, could be considered the wrong thing if they hadn't succeeded. They had to commit 110%. Now, those 56 men, I ask again that all of us ponder, if they had a roll call vote, how many of us would be willing to stand up and be counted as number 57? It's an honor and privilege to serve beside all of you, especially you, Johnny Ringo, and people like you, Jennifer, and all the rest of you on the call, and Brent tonight. Thank you for the honor and the privilege of you guys allowing me to serve beside you. Back to you, Michael.
All righty. And, Johnny, you have another comment to add to this, please?
Yeah, if either one of you gentlemen would be interested in reading some very interesting literature created by these men in original leather-bound books. Most of them are signed by the original men. Just let me know. It's very, very interesting read.
One does not have to even hesitate. Absolutely, I would read it all. Voraciously.
Rather thick, but these are for men that created the Constitution, and they explain why and how.
Oh. So am I. I'm rather thick. I may have to read it twice.
Two and three times, because some of the language they use or the wording is rather difficult to understand because they had a different vocabulary back then. But I can furnish an unabridged dictionary to look up a lot of stuff, of which I have over in the last winter, and it's very interesting reading.
Well, I'm looking forward to getting you and your libraries down here to Florida. I truly am.
Sounds good. You take care, guys.
And a copy of Bouvier's Law.
Okay.
Okay.
All right,
back to you, Michael.
I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. I remind you that tomorrow night, Wednesday night, 9 o'clock, same phone, same pin, I will be sharing with you how to operate and control a limited liability company that has no tax liability associated with it, and to dispel any of the rumors and law, showing you in law, where the January 1st law that came into or law that came into effect January 1st that required removing the secrecy behind limited liabilities companies has been now adjudicated unconstitutional. So that removes any of these obstacles that were raised earlier this year. So join me then tomorrow, same phone number, same pin. Until then, good night, everyone. John, thank you so much for being here tonight. I know you had to go out of your way to get a good, clear signal from your current venue, and I appreciate you going out of your way. Thank you very much. Until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.